Hey, you are listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace. I'm your host, Sabine M., and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Kirsty Groves. Kirsty is a workplace strategist, innovation consultant, author, and podcaster. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm with a fellow podcaster, Kirsty Groves. She has the podcast that's called The Office Chronicles. I'm going to ask her more about that later. But to start off, hi, Kirsty.
Hello, Sabine. How are you?
I'm good. Hope you're too.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Besides being a podcaster, what is your job today and what's your professional background?
Oh, okay. So my job today is, if I were to put it on a little kind of label in a meeting, virtual or physical, it would be a workplace strategist. So I am a consultant effectively, and I work with organizations to help them define their workplace strategy and then also to kind of influence any design that they might need for that environments, and then finally to help them to activate it as well. So going all the way from the visioning side of things through to defining, implementing, and then kind of making it work. So I help clients do that. And my background is engineering as my master's, kind of my undergraduate master's, and then I moved into industrial design. So I have a kind of the engineering side of things. And then I also have the kind of, the design and art side of things. And then I moved quite swiftly into product design and looking at kind of future technologies and how they might be integrated into things that people actually need and want. So I can think that kind of is very relevant to what I do today. And then I moved into, I like to say I kind of swam upstream, if you like. So I started with kind of how stuff works. And then I started looking at, you know, why would people actually ever want them in the first place? And then I moved into innovation consulting. And that was really much more about ideation, about creativity, and then even unlocking it in teams and organizations. And it was at that point that I started missing the kind of the tangible stuff of creativity, which was kind of space. And B, I saw that there was a real opportunity for organizations to use physical space as a lever for innovation. So that's kind of how I ended up becoming interested and working in this whole arena.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm quite fascinated lately by people just having kind of this jungle gym career, like just following their passion and one thing leads to another. And then they find where they can bring all that they've learned in their past development so far together. Mm. So that I think is really cool. And probably that's going to be what the future is going to be like as our working lives are getting longer. And most likely we won't be able to do one thing for our whole life and probably don't even want to.
Right, right. And I think the world needs a lot more kind of agility and maybe kind of cross-fertilization of skills and things. And I like the expression squiggly career. There's a bit of a movement which is about really making that acceptable. I never thought of myself as having a squiggly career, but I do remember, you know, on very many occasions kind of almost justifying how I got to where I got to. And when I look back, it makes sense. But actually, you know, when you're living it at the time, it really is kind of, okay, so where do I want to go? And, you know, where can I best, put the skills that I have to use.
Yeah. Now, I noted on your LinkedIn profile as well that you call yourself a space coach. Mm. What does a space coach do?
Aha. So that was a label given to me actually by a client. Yeah. So a client of mine, we realized about 3 or 4 years ago now that actually majority of the work I was doing with her was coaching. And she is the head of space for a fantastic company called MVF. And then I just started doing a lot more work with her. And I realized over time that actually where I was adding a lot of value was actually helping the organizations to implement things themselves. Because ultimately, I think, you know, it has to be owned and it has to be about co-creation. So that's really, you know, what it's about. I don't just kind of come in audit and tell people what to do. I very much, work alongside and also kind of behind sometimes and, give people the tools. And I guess also the kind of the mindset that they need to be able to navigate their way through this kind of now even more kind of increasingly changing world of work.
Yeah, it is true that now with the question of what the office is going to be, there's really some coaching required for people to have an open mind about things and really question, do we need the cubicles, the desks, the way we have had them all the time, or can we do something really new? So I think that's a good approach to it, actually.
Well, and also just on that, that's kind of the one very, I would say, the kind of the most, the initial point. And then there's also the fact that you have internal viewpoints that might differ. You might have barriers to overcome internally, i.e. with senior stakeholders, with employees, with peers, and also just having that kind of someone who's got your back, who's not inside the organization, who is not encumbered by the day-to-day. I think that is kind of one of the key things I've identified, or actually, as I said, my client kind of identified that, you know, is a hugely valuable thing. So I've just kind of really stepped into that now, and I'm, you know, doing a lot more of that. And I find that all of my capability building and facilitation work that I did as an innovation consultant and creativity capability consultant has really come into fore for that. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's kind of, it's that kind of questioning the mindset, but then also kind of helping to influence internally as well.
And sometimes having that outside view on things can help as well, because if you're like in things, you get wrapped in by the day to day. You rarely have the time to really do that step back, and probably you get blind to it as well at some point.
Oh my God, it's the same with me and my, my own work environment, my own kind of workflow and productivity. I need external people to help me, So absolutely, I think it's just one of those things that is a really valuable tool that I don't think many people think, realize that they need.
Yeah. Coming back to your podcast, The Office Chronicles, it's charting the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on workplaces. How did that start out?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, it started originally because I just wanted to do a podcast. So it was a bit similar to the first book I wrote. I just kind of knew that there was a book in me when I decided to write my first book. And similarly, I kind of knew that there was a podcast in me. It's one of those things, I knew everyone was doing podcasts. I thought, oh, I really love the idea of doing that. So there was a friend of mine who is a really fantastic workplace designer. We had a conversation she said, we should do a podcast together. And I was like, oh my God, I've been thinking about it. So we kind of explored it for a couple of years, really. And it just never really got off the ground. And I just couldn't, but at the same time, I couldn't let it go. And we just couldn't really kind of figure out because there's some really good podcasts out there around work and workplace. And it was really just a kind of a moment when I was driving with my husband, and we just said, look, there's so much going on. People really need to share what they're thinking about and sometimes just externalize what they're talking about. So just talk it out. So I just thought, even if this is a podcast that only runs for, at the time I said, even if it only runs for 6 months, this is kind of the middle of the year in 2020. Even if it only runs for 6 months, it would be really good to hear from leaders in organizations who are open enough to share and, what they're thinking, how they're thinking it. So that's kind of how it started. And the way it's evolved, interestingly, is from I think the earlier podcasts were really talking about kind of setting out the strategy and the thinking and, are we going to be hybrid or are we not? And how are we going to tackle flexibility and what is the office for? Actually, one of the first questions was, is the office dead? Because that was the conversation kind of back then. And now it's moved much more into the kind of nuts and bolts around how people are starting to implement their strategies and the roadblocks that they're coming across and how they're getting around them. So it's been really interesting, the podcast and the topic and the guests themselves are all evolving as time goes on.
Yeah. Do you have some interesting or surprising findings from these conversations?
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. So one of the things that's really great is that, so I'm typically speaking with large, well-known organizations. So we have a conversation with Twitter, with Lego, two conversations with Lego, actually. We looped back with them, with AstraZeneca, with Airbus. So there's kind of, you know, some big names in there. We have lined up some, you know, really interesting ones as well, including, hopefully, fingers crossed, Google, McDonald's, and maybe Virgin as well, Atlantic. So we've got some really big names across lots and lots of different industries. But the thing that's really interesting across all of them is that many of the themes and the insights that are coming from them can be applied, A, across industry, and B, in terms of scale. So for example, one of the big insights that really blew my mind when I first heard it, and now it sounds so obvious, was just at the time everyone was kind of talking about, you know, we understand that there was a huge amount of challenges around working from home and remote work, and people were really grappling with the idea of allowing their employees to work more flexibly. But then the flip side of that is, how do we get people to come into the office, because we also know it's really good for certain other things? And one of the insights that came from, I think, the first Lego interview that we had with Tim Ahrensbach was the notion of, an aha for him as well, was that, yes, we want to provide environments so that people can be their best selves and do their best work, whether that be from home, whether that be from, you know, a third space, whether that be in the office. But also we need them to understand that it's about being the best colleague that they can be also. So it's not just about the individual and what works for me all the time. It's also considering what's good for my team and for the organization. So, you know, that was a really, you know, fundamental, I think, insight that came quite early on. And I know that there are lots of people who told me that that's been a real kind of a really helpful guiding principle for them when they're developing their hybrid working strategy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've mentioned yourself, you've written a book, and I've noted it down here as well. It's called Spaces for Innovation, The Design and Science of Inspiring Environments. Mm-hmm. Can you give us an outline of what makes inspiring environments?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that's my second book, that one. That was 2016. So my first book was in 2010, and I can give you the context of that because I think they kind of fit quite interestingly together. But what makes for an inspiring work environment, I think this was a really interesting kind of exploration into, you know, research and then insight that came out through a commission by Nesta, which is an innovation charity based in the UK. And they were about to kind of move offices themselves. And they thought, well, we know pretty much, you know, everything there is to know about people innovation, process innovation, experience, etc. But we have no real point of view around whether physical space has a role to play in innovation or not. And actually, internally, they were having a massive debate because some people were saying that space really does matter. Intuitively, they knew that they could be in an environment and it would really inspire them to kind of create or to behave in a way that was more creative. And then other people were saying, yeah, but you just need to look at the, you know, the origins of some of the biggest innovations in the world. You know, MIT Building 20 was, you know, just a rabbit warren, kind of almost like a, you know, shed-like rabbit warren. And, you know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak kind of invented Apple in a garage. You know, you'd have these kind of like conflicting stories. So the whole point of the book was to really kind of investigate that. But one of the key insights that we had that really surprised the team when we presented it back was that there were kind of, we lay out 10 factors that go into an inspiring or creating a space for innovation that really inspires. And only 3 out of those 10 are what you'd consider to be the kind of the typical physical spatial attributes. So for example, proximity, you know, whether you're close to somebody or not, the kind of the basic elements of the kind of physical experience, you know, light, temperature, sound, etc., movement, spaciousness. And then the other one was much more around kind of tools and activities for creating or kind of running the innovation process. The other seven were actually much less tangible. So the things like the impetus, the kind of the whole reason, the purpose of the environment that you're creating, the leadership and how you lead through that, how you invite people to engage in the process in the space itself. So a whole host of different intangible aspects to creating an environment. And I think that was a bit of a surprise to them. We kind of intuitively knew that, but I think we kind of surprised ourselves too. But it was all backed up by a whole ton of scientific research that we kind of we investigated, but also speaking to lots of practitioners as well. So I don't know if that's entirely answered your question, but I think also for me, when we work with organizations to build inspiring work environments, we kind of use a model that I've developed off of one that was initiated by DEGW, which is now kind of ACOM. And it kind of builds upon their model, which was around efficiency, effectiveness, and expression. And we've kind of laddered on top of that in a kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs way to kind of look at things like empowerment, evolution, kind of external environment, and then things like energy as well. So we kind of take into account all of these different factors, look at those through the lens of, yes, the space, but also through people and also the organization, to come up with a kind of an appropriate set of objectives for an organization so that you can almost create your own blueprint. So that's in a nutshell how I think, you know, the kind of elements that are needed to really think through what makes an environment really inspiring.
Yeah, I think the key is really thinking things through, because I see so many promotional videos now on LinkedIn and everywhere with people walking through white offices and wondering why nobody wants to be back and what the purpose of the office is going to be. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be back in that space either. So
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the other thing. I think you're absolutely right. It's also the same organization going, well, you know, we've just had a new refurb just before the pandemic. We've got all new stuff. Look, it's all amazing. Why aren't people wanting to come? Because we've all gone through an incredibly different experience of work. And so the lessons need to be learned about those experiences and dynamics. And I think it needs to be really rethought, readdressed, if you like.
Yeah.
Through that lens. So it's a little bit of kind of looking back as to how people have fared that kind of the last couple of years, because it is going to be a couple of years at least, isn't it? Of course. But then also not losing sight of the higher objective and where you really want to take the organization. And I think it's, you know, it's essential. I think it's really, really easy for some organizations just to kind of either be in denial and then just say, look, everybody get back into the office as soon as you can. You know, it's not, nothing's changed, nothing to see here. Everything's the same, and hope for the best, or kind of stick their head in the sand. It's kind of easy to do that and just kind of go, you know, but I think it's really dangerous because, you know, we've got lots of, people making big decisions about where they want to work now.
Yeah. I mean, what's inspiring to you is subjective, but sticking the head in the sand and just doing nothing, I don't think that's the right option. Just give us something to work with that we see there is an effort to at least meet your employees where they are.
Mm. That's a really good point. Absolutely. And I think, you know, just building on what you've just said, I think it's really good clarification actually for me in terms of, inspiring being objective. I think, yes, absolutely to an individual, but also when an organization can find its inspiration and what kind of its purpose and link the experience that they want the workplace to deliver with that, then that will ultimately kind of give you some kind of, I used to call it environmental resonance. You know, it's kind of like when I've learned not to use such big words anymore because it confuses myself as well as everybody. Like, what on earth does that mean? I almost think kind of visually or kind of, you know, schematically, I just, you know, you've got the rhythm of the organization. If you've got the kind of, if you've got something that really resonates with people in terms of, you know, I can just plug in, I can just get stuff done on one hand, but actually I'm in this space because I'm really part of something bigger than me. Then that kind of gives you the kind of where the culture kind of meets the organizational raison d'etre, meets the physical space to support. So I think they're the kind of really important pieces. Just actually, I remembered why I came up with that now. It was actually a really good, I don't know if you've read this book. It's quite old. yeah, it's quite old now, but it's just awesome. I love it. It's called Make Space by the D School, which is in Stanford. And it's just kind of, you know, a really practical book that talks about how they designed the space for innovation, specifically for teaching people to kind of, you know, become innovators. So it's kind of an educational space, but it still has so many principles that any, you know, organization who wants to enhance innovation can kind of glean from it. But in there, there's a quote, and they don't even know who said it. And so if anybody knows who said this, and, you know, please, I'd love to kind of quote them properly, but space is the body language of an organization. And I just think that's really awesome. Yeah.
So if you've got, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Space is the body language of an organization. So it's kind of, you know, it's not shouting at you. It's just demonstrating what you're all about and, you know, what you care about and who you are. So
yeah,
that's really nice.
I love it as well, because body language can be subconscious to you. And oftentimes what the office expresses to the world might be subconscious to the company as well and not really intentional at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the decisions that people make when it comes to their physical, the spaces that they create, speaks volumes. And it can be sometimes things that are overlooked that can give off that subconscious kind of message, or, you know, the message that the leadership team has just kind of not really paid attention to, but the employees pick up on. But equally, you know, to the outside world as well. So there can be things that, you know, you really pay attention to that make people feel really valued, you know, whether it be giving over more space to things like social or kind of collaborative or kind of kitchen space than, you know, something else, or kind of making a decision around the importance of provision of, I don't know, breakfast or lunch or something. You just, sometimes it can be really the small subtle things that can make a really big difference.
Yeah. I have not forgotten that you mentioned your first book and that it fits nicely with the second one. So I'm still curious what the first book was about.
Oh, thanks, Sabine. I love that curiosity. So the first book is called I Wish I Worked There. That was the reason I kind of got into the whole world of workplace consulting. I didn't even know it was a thing, right? At that point, I was just curious. So, and I Wish I Worked There is just a behind the scenes of, we whittled it down to 20 organizations who care about kind of innovation, who are innovative. And it was just a kind of me first kind of going and seeing, you know, what they're doing and then seeing if there were any patterns. So I just, yeah, had a hypothesis, but I, you know, didn't really have any kind of working experience around it. And the reason, I think the link between the two is, if the first book is kind of what people were doing, you know, what makes a great space for innovation or creativity or, you know, work environment, the second book is how to do it. Sorry, why? How to do it is book number three. And I literally have just reminded myself that I promised that I would write this third book. Yes, the first is the what, then it's the why, you know, why space matters, you know, all of the evidence that you might need to kind of convince others or even to understand yourself. And then the third one will be, it's kind of third way through writing, put down because of the pandemic, hopefully pick up at some point in the future. Yeah.
Picking your brain then on the how, what are some of the common misperceptions when it comes to creating offices that foster collaboration and creativity?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. I think a lot of the misconceptions, I mean, one of the major ones, major, is that collaboration equals everybody in it together all the time, and creativity equals lots of bright colors and, you know, I mean, that's
brick walls.
Yeah. Brick walls. Exactly. Brick walls, exposed ducts, you know, following the latest trend, or I like to say bar stools and breakouts, or, you know, post-it notes everywhere. A thing will not make you or your people creative. You cannot just expect to install a foosball table, whatever you want to call it, or a slide, and then expect creativity to happen. That's like super fundamental, number one. And I think the other one is, and building on that, I think one of the most important things is to understand your process. There's the kind of fundamental human elements that kind of support creativity, and they are your real basic things like natural light, exposure to nature, movement, and all of those kinds of things. So if you have kind of the ability for people to move around, I'll give you a really great example. I worked with quite a while ago now, just this very small part of Lego, which was called the Innovation Lab. And there's only about a team of about 40, 50 people. And they had, they were quite, so the rest of Lego was kind of managed by, you know, their very, very strong internal kind of workplace development team. But these guys were kind of slightly maverick. And they were like, you know, we don't have much money. You know, we quite like the fact that we kind of operate on a shoestring. But we think we're missing a trick when it comes to our space. We literally have to do this ourselves. And so I walked in, and when I first saw it, by the way, one of their values or principles, the ways of working, you know, they all kind of really buy into, was respectful rebellion, which I thought was really good. Don't splash the cash, respectful rebellion. They're two kind of key ones that I remember. And I walked around, and I saw this kind of really big space that was kind of very empty, apart from these massive sit-stand tables. And when we continued to walk around, there were all these kind of very hidden spaces where there was kind of piles and piles of Lego bricks and lots of whiteboards and writing on it, but it was all a bit kind of overwhelming and kind of a little bit like, whoa, what's going on here? And a couple of things were going on there. One was the sit-stand desks were actually, at the time, they were just kind of, you know, very positively standard issue. Okay, so, you know, this is an idea that, you know, people will kind of be more healthy because they can sit, they can stand, they can move around. But the opposite was happening, in that people would walk in, stand or sit at the space, and then not move around at all. So it was actually a really quite a static environment, ironically. And then there was another thing attached to the kind of the secluded spaces, which was to do with security. But there were a couple of things that we did just to really understand, you know, observe, understand, think about the process and how important things, like, for example, they had like four major projects in a year that they would kind of really focus upon. And what we were able to do by understanding that, also by understanding that the reason they were hiding things away was because they were afraid, being on the ground floor, that people could see in through the windows. And in fact, actually, that was attached to this one time when somebody forgot to turn the blinds down at night. So we're kind of living in darkness during the day. What we were able to do was actually remove a lot of these sit-stand tables, create a space that was a lot more kind of dynamic in the center, but then actually also have much bigger closed off, four focused kind of project areas, which then had people moving around a lot more. It had people feeling much more free to move around because they had this kind of private space. And it also allowed them to invite other people into the space in this kind of, you know, semi-private space that they could invite kind of, you know, potential partners and everything in. So it's just kind of a really good example of, you know, you can bring in things like movement and focus into a space if you really understand what the process is for the kind of the organization's kind of innovation process and creativity. So just building on that, the notion of individual quiet time is something that I think is often really overlooked when people try to shift almost to this kind of more creative, collaborative environment. And we're seeing that a lot now in a post-pandemic kind of definition of what the office might be. You know, on one hand, people are saying, look, we want you to have the flexibility to decide where you want to work so you can work from home on your own and get your head down. And then when you come into the office, it's going to be all about collaboration. And you're going to come in, you're going to be in a meeting room sometimes, you're going to be in a big collaborative space. And then there's nowhere to actually focus, get your head down, or be kind of quiet. And that has like two major flaws to it. One is that there are some people who can't actually work from home for a start and need to have, you know, that kind of quiet head down space on site. And number two, you know, actually, there are many moments in time when individual creativity requires reflection. And so I think one of the big things I'm seeing is people are forgetting, you know, it's not a kind of A, one size fits all, but B, there are different kind of settings that are needed for different styles of thinking and different activities that people do.
Yeah. And it comes down to being very basic. We as humans, we are creative beings. When we feel safe, when we feel cared for, when we are well, generally. So if there is light and movement, so all like the healthy stuff, then we naturally tend to be creative. So you need to tap into that, which shouldn't be too difficult, allowing for that.
Absolutely. That's the kind of fundamental level. Absolutely. If you also, going back to what I was saying about the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there's a really great way of thinking about this, which has been put down by a lady called Jacqueline Visscher. And she talks about kind of environmental comfort. And, you know, below, there's kind of, imagine a triangle, and kind of at the baseline, that's like, it's habitable. An environment is habitable. If you go below that, then it becomes a very distracting environment. And that, you know, we all know that it's too hot, it's too cold, you know, you're sitting underneath an air vent, or, you know, it's too much glare, it's too visually distracting. They're all really important baseline environmental factors. People need, just as human beings, to be able to concentrate, to be able to kind of get stuff done. Then a little bit further up that, it's about feeling kind of, you know, having, they're kind of functional, if you like. Then a little bit above that is about well-being. It's not just about not being distracted. It's about feeling, okay, cool, I can get on with this. I'm really kind of getting into some kind of work here. I feel quite happy. I feel well. I've got a clear head, those kinds of things. And then above that is where I would say your creativity factors come in. And they are things like a sense of being really stimulated in the right way. Like, okay, well, you know, there's somebody over there I can go and talk to, or there's an event that I know is going on, or there's colors in here I really kind of make me feel like I can get stuff done, or there's a bit of a buzz going on in the background, or like you say, I feel like I can contribute. I feel safe, but I also feel like I can contribute. My ideas are accepted and, you know, and positively challenged. So all of those things are kind of layered up from both an individual level and actually then also an organizational level. Yeah, it's really, really interesting, really, really important. I think it's not just nice to have spaces that have natural light. It's kind of, you know, an absolute hygiene factor, fundamental.
Yeah. I've heard a couple of organizations being like, hey, the office is just going to be for collaboration and creativity. People can work individually from home. You've touched upon it. This is not possible for everybody. And there will still need to be touchdown spaces, spaces for focus work. How do you see the purpose of the office for the future?
That's a really, really good question. I think the short answer is it depends. I've been quoted on that before. It depends. It really depends on the organization. So for example, you know, an organization that is in tech, for example, where everything can be remote, then there's, and the workflow is such that, and the organizational work contract, if you like, the way that people work together, you know, so for example, Decoded or Basecamp or, you know, any of those kind of all remote companies who've established their culture as remote, that's kind of one thing. So if they do have something that's on site, it will be pretty much for inspiration and collaboration. Then you've got kind of the organizations that have co-located things on site, for example, they simply can't be done at home, like, you know, labs or maker spaces or factories or whatever. So one of the things that we do just to kind of help organizations to understand what their purpose for the office is to look at it from a couple of different angles. One is from the employee angle. You know, what is it that will motivate an employee to come into the office? And that will be, in some cases, role dependent. In other cases, it will be personality dependent or situation dependent. So we look at personas of employees as opposed to just a role. You know, you are, for example, a leader, therefore you're probably going to be on site 3 days a week. It's not as clear cut as that. So we do that from that kind of that perspective. Then we also look at it from the organization's perspective. What are the things where we know that groups need to gather, and how often and in what format and for what purpose? And actually at that point gives us an opportunity to say, how might that change? How do we want it to change? And then we can start to kind of define what those kind of group activities might be on site. So you've got kind of two things going on where you've got the organization almost kind of drawing people into site for specific kind of organizational kind of group activities. Then you also have the kind of the individual's perspective and why they might choose to go into the office as a destination. And then that's how you can work out the cadence and also the balance of space that you need to provide for your unique set of people. And so even within one organization, that's going to differ from site to site. You might have, you know, an overarching set of principles, like a strategy globally, but that might then also be just kind of tweaked locally depending on the population and the mini culture of that set of people.
Yeah. Very important question adding on to that, actually. How do you make sure to balance business needs and employee experience? Because I feel oftentimes it's still competing, because business needs normally is like get baseline down, low investments and kind of things, mm-hmm. but employee experience should be a conscious investment. So where do you find that line to walk?
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, threads through pretty much everything we've been talking about today. And that is that there's a defined philosophy and strategy from the organization level, which has a commitment to providing, you know, the best experience for their colleagues in order to, for them to do their best work, in order to make the business operate as its best. And it's really tying those things together at an objective level. And so when you work out your workplace objectives, it's always about making sure that there's a balance of executives setting those objectives, getting alignment around them, and making sure that they're spread across things that might be more kind of efficiency driven versus those that might be a bit more future focused. And so when you kind of set those out, then you can make the right decisions around making an environment that has the best of both.
Yeah. I've recently been on a panel, which is more for fun, because one of the questions there was like, you'll get the choice of A, B, C. Either you get A, unlimited budget. And the question was to corporate real estate executives, workplace mm-hmm. strategists mm-hmm. and so on. Either A, unlimited budget to do what you want, or B, you know what's going to happen with the pandemic when it's over and when everybody can be back in the office and stuff, or C, you get alignment with the leadership on what the way is going forward. What would you choose?
Alignment.
I was the same as like alignment, because the other are not going to matter if you have that.
Yeah. You can have all the money in the world, and if you don't have the leaders aligned, then, you know, you can be spending it till the end of the world. and you know, knowing what's going to happen, that's just like, yeah. And then what, you know, it's like, I think that is a desire of most of human beings. We always kind of want to know what the answer is. And the truth is, it's always going to evolve. And if it didn't, then we wouldn't be going anywhere. So I think that's a big thing that I've noticed actually through this pandemic is, A, executives seem to be actually coming together in a way that they weren't before. A lot of my work pre-pandemic was actually raising the argument around space to the board table to say, look, this is a strategic lever that you should be paying attention to, guys, and you need to be involved in it. It's not just about corporate real estate. You need to get them at the table too. Now I'm being approached by almost ready formed cross-functional teams, because they know that the remit is more than just, you know, one-sided. That's number one. And I think number two is a real appreciation that, not with everyone, but it is a journey, and a test and learn mindset is needed. And that, you know, it's not just about creating the fixed finished thing and then walking away from it, which, you know, is it, again, pre-pandemic, that was kind of, it was almost like an uphill struggle trying to kind of educate people that that's how the workplace should be approached anyway.
Yeah, that's true. In that sense, we do have some back, do you call it backwind? I'm like, not only familiar with headwind, I think, but it's like
tailwind.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So now we have tailwind. Mm. I'm granting people a magical wish on this podcast. Mm. So if you could magically solve any workplace problem, what would it be?
If I could solve any workplace problem, what would it be? From my perspective or from the organization's perspective?
You can choose. It's your magical wish.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I think it would be to get the purse holders, the people who have pressure around knowing what the answer is right now, spending as little as money as possible, to give the workplace leaders a bit of time. And I think because that's what's needed right now, and I think it's always going to be needed. So I think there's something around the problem I would solve would be the way that budgets are handled and the way that they are planned mm-hmm. over the workplace cycle.
Yeah, that's a very good one. My wish changes every time I record a podcast, right? This week, following your time one, I would say remove fear for organizations to be embracing what's coming and not cling to old stigmas of the way things were done.
Yeah, that's a great one. I think it's a great one. Don't worry if you make a mistake, because actually that's how you learn.
Yeah, that's going back to the testing that you've mentioned before.
Absolutely.
Now is the time to do that and expect to fail. If you're not failing, I think you're doing something wrong, actually.
Which ties in beautifully with innovation. That's what it's all about, right? You can't innovate if you do exactly what you've already done. You have to just expect that there's a little bit of stretch that's required, which I love this. It's all very neatly kind of tied up, because it is that whole comfort zone thing though, isn't it? You know, you feel comfortable in the known, you feel uncomfortable in the unknown, but if you always stay doing what you've always done, you're never going to try something new.
Yeah.
And what's needed is fresh thinking around this stuff.
Yeah. So we've gone full span with this conversation. I have one very last question, and that is, who else should I have on the podcast? And is there something you would like to ask them?
Oh, that's a great one. Who else should you have on the podcast? I'm going to steal this, by the way. That's a great question.
Sure.
Have you had Neil Usher?
No.
You should have Neil Usher.
Okay.
Yeah. Neil Usher. And I think you should ask him, why is being a philosopher important as a workplace leader?
Ooh, now I'm very intrigued by this suggestion. I will have to look.
I know. And now I'm thinking, why haven't I done that for my podcast? No, that's great. That's great. Well, I've got a different target set of people to ask. That's fine.
No, noted this down. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun, Kirsty. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it too, Sabine. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. We have just released a study on data readiness in CRE, along with the opportunity to assess your organization's workplace insight score. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.